what is likely to come to pass. And Kipling's mind was very far from shut up in a study. He wasn't that kind of man at all. In fact, if he had a weakness, it was that he wrote too fast and often didn't think enough about the finish and the materials of a particular piece. Kipling was, however, well-grounded in past literary practice. But he didn't permit this past literary practice to determine for him the course which he was going to follow. It didn't keep him from using a new idea or treating it in a new way. In part, this came about because of the entire freshness of a large part of his material. He had really struck a gold mine in starting to write about India. He knew it, and almost nobody else did. And he had a market for anything he wanted to write, and he was a journalist and could turn it off fast. And so he capitalized upon this wonderful setup with a whole shelf full of books. He knew his stuff. He used his own judgment as to its proper development. And instead of following other people's literary modes, he set his own. Kipling had two great sides to his genius. And it's easy in exalting one to forget the other. He saw and recorded with extraordinary vividness, but he wasn't just a photographer. He was an interpreter, both of what he saw and of the characters whom he introduces to these scenes. It's easy to underestimate Kipling, because he tells a story so smoothly and easily, it's easy to forget that there may be a point to it. He had his blind spots. Perhaps the worst blind spot was his attitude toward imperialism, toward England, the world empire. He couldn't help feeling a certain kind of rightness in power. His point of view was that England was civilized, that it was the white man's burden to carry this civilization to benighted people and ram it down their throats. That is, that it was good for them, and that it was better for the countries in question to be run by this power in Europe than it was to let them run it themselves. He had strong prejudices, but he would probably not have been at all reluctant about admitting that he had them. He was never a backward advocate of imperialism. He believed in it right down to the ground. He thought it was good for the world. Kipling's relation to the full-fledged novel bears some resemblance to Stevenson's relation to it. Here again, as in the case of Stevenson, I am treating an author a very large part of whose work doesn't strictly fall within this course. One is more prone in Kipling's case to attribute his failure to do more in the field of the novel to impatience and to a wish to get on to something else than perhaps to an inability to do it. When we were talking about Stevenson, we stressed the fact that there was a certain constitutional lack in Stevenson of the feeling for structure on the one hand and of the constitution to carry it out on the other. Both men were supplying material in great quantities for periodicals. And like a man who writes dramatic criticism on a deadline for tomorrow morning's paper, it serves as an automatic control upon his disposition to spread a thing out over pages and pages or to spend a great deal of time in polishing his sentences. So that the conditions of publication probably conditioned the writing of a good deal of this work. Furthermore, both Stevenson and Kipling had the ability to concentrate rather than to elaborate. The ability to do a thing in short space and do it well and do it under pressure rather than to spin a thing out gracefully into all of its possible side issues. Yet with all of this pressure for production, Kipling shows us a serious conception of his task and a steady evolution upward. No other author has interpreted in brief form so many phases of human life in so many ways. The difference between the earliest tales from Kipling's pen and those of his later maturity is one of an increasingly profound knowledge of humanity and of character. Any careful reader of his poetry, as well as of his fiction, becomes aware that his development in this respect continued almost to the end of his days. Nothing could be more baseless than the charge that he never emerged from the adolescence of genius. That last sentence, quoted from Gerald, gives us a view on through to the end, the latter work as well as the first. First among the list of his novels was the story, The Light That Failed. The chief characters in this touching story are Dick Heldar, H-E-L-D-A-R, who's an artist, and Maisie, his companion from childhood. Maisie has looks and attractiveness, but these conceal something of essential shallowness in her nature. This story is a little devastating in its study of feminine nature. Apparently, Kipling wasn't a sentimentalist in this respect. Our hero has been sent off to the Sudan, a region south of Egypt, west of the Red Sea, as far as French Equatorial Africa, that general region in which two or three famous military episodes in English history occurred. General Gordon's English army was massacred there at Khartoum in 1885. This was a tremendous loss of faith for the English in the Sudan, which they were determined to revenge or avenge. And that was done by Kitchener in 1898 at the Battle of Omdurman, O-M-D-U-R-A-M. This was the part of the reputation of Kitchener which led to making him the commander-in-chief of the British armies in the last war, though he had also done service in South Africa as well. Our hero was there to furnish an English paper with some drawings. And Heldar suffers a blow on the head, destined to bring him eventual tragedy, though he doesn't know it then. Unknowing what had happened to him, he returns happily to London.